Hello, world. Do we ever, ever not have a great time in New Orleans? And we just had another great time. Hello, Robert.
Hello. Yeah, we did have a good time.
And by the way, they're listening to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter.
Yeah, Hake. We forgot to mention that.
Yeah, well, here we are.
As usual, it's after all, if it's Sunday morning or it's part of your weekly podcast routine, you'd expect that this would be happening, and sure it is. Off we went to New Orleans for the New Orleans
Wine
and
Food
Experience,
yeah.
Otherwise known as NAWFI, at a time when New Orleans is experiencing yet another challenge.
Oh, please.
To the economic system and the community of interest, especially in seafood in New Orleans, which I'm sure you know altogether too much about.
It makes me so angry.
But what we got was a positive spin on that.
We did.
Because New Orleanians give a positive spin to everything that goes on. They're survivors. If they can get past Katrina, they can get past this one as well. And everybody said so.
Although I really thought that the whole matter would be resolved by the time we aired this.
Well, we certainly hoped that, but then now it doesn't seem like it.
No.
Maybe some miracle will have happened between the time we're recording this program and you're actually listening to it. Who can tell?
Okay, but let's go directly to the chairperson of this event.
Yeah,
there are actually two
chair people together.
Okay.
And then we talked to someone to give us an inside track on what's going on to the most important product for New Orleans cooking, which is seafood. So we talked to somebody from the Louisiana Seafood Association. And then we thought what interesting it would be to cast back in time. So the 2006 James Beard Awards were dedicated, the Humanitarian Awards of the Year was dedicated to all the chefs of the Crescent City of New Orleans, and two representatives, Frank Brightson of Brightson's Restaurant and Leah Chase of Dookie Chase, were there, and we had a chance to talk to them. By now, that's more than 4 years ago, as they talked about how New Orleans was already recovering from Katrina, and you may be sure from listening to these same people who are soldiering on that they'll make the same recovery from this ecological disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. So here we go with the introduction to our program about New Orleans. Right after Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans, and you'll understand why we're talking New Orleans again in just a second, the James Beard Foundation dedicated their 2006 awards to the community of New Orleans and the restaurateurs in particular of the city. And city representatives Frank Brightson and Leah Chase said, "We only need one thing from you, America and the world. It's to come back to New Orleans. This is a community that hangs together." We're fast forward to 2010, and another difficulty has reached this community. And guess what? This community is standing together again. So we're here talking to two representatives of the 2010 New Orleans Wine and Food Experience. Introduce yourselves, gentlemen, and then tell us how you're helping the community to face this challenge that's now happening in the Gulf.
My name is Randy Stein. I'm the general manager of Mr. B's Bistro. As far as the challenge in the Gulf, up to this point, for us here in the French Quarter, it hasn't been that bad yet. We've seen a very small increase in the price of shrimp, but other than that, we're doing fine, and we know that our good fishermen down on the coast are going to survive this. We're going to help them all we can, and hopefully today's the day they're going to turn the damn thing off as we speak, but we're going to get through this just like we got through Katrina.
And I'm Greg Reggio. I'm the last year's president of the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience, still one of the board members, and I own Zia Restaurant based out of New Orleans down here. And, you know, it's funny. People think of New Orleans, and they really think we're a coastal city, but actually we're pretty far inland. I mean, you know, this spill that's occurred, this leak that's occurred, is pretty far out. It's about 100 miles south of here. You know, there's a lot of effects and all that, but it's not like it's lapping up against the shores of Bourbon Street. You know, you can still come to New Orleans, and you will definitely see everything you've loved about New Orleans. It hasn't affected the city from the standpoint of the quality of life that we have down here. There are some challenges with the seafood, but you know, we're working through that. I mean, I think the greatest thing about what we do down here in the South is the authorities have been very proactive and being very careful to make sure that no seafood that may have been tainted gets anywhere near the marketplace. I mean, in fact, to a fault almost. I mean, they closed down a lot of the oyster beds and fishing areas very early on well before the spillet reached any of the fishing grounds. So you can be assured that any of the Louisiana seafood that you see in the marketplace right now has been unaffected.
But I was also talking about the way the community comes together to support itself and to raise money. The event of the Wine and Food Experience is a money-raising venture in and of itself. But within the last week or 10 days, two particularly special people stepped up and said, we want to do more. Greg, tell us a little bit about what Paula Dean and John Bash are doing.
You know, Chef John Bash, he's a real ambassador of our city. He truly cares about what happens down here in South Louisiana. And you know, he was one of the first guys to go down there and feed some of the first responders, making sure that their bellies were full while they were out there working hard to correct the situation. Yeah, with his contacts that he's had through all of his, you know, his national TV programs, and Paula Dean were talking, and she expressed an interest in coming down and raising some money, you know, for the fishermen, for the people that are down there working hard to correct our situation down there. And between the two of them, they put together a wonderful event. Timing was great for the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience. She decided to come on down. She's actually going to do a live cooking demonstration. Of course, I don't know, is there any other kind of cooking demonstration that isn't live? But she'll be there in the flesh, and she's doing that at her grand tasting on Saturday. And then we're going to press her into service later on that day. She'll be doing a special meal at John's Restaurant, August, Restaurant August, right here in the French Quarter. And it's going to do some marvelous event. And all the monies that are raised are going to go to the Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries Foundation to help in the efforts to clean up the coast.
Well, I think that's just a wonderful thing. By the time this interview airs, that event will be over. But I did want to recognize what these people are doing, because it's just a wonderful example of how this city stays together.
Now, this is certainly not the first of this annual event. Can you give us a little story about how it got started? And like, it's too late this year, but next year people might want to come.
Well, you know, some of the things that you all have mentioned has been about how this community comes together. And, you know, very early on, we saw a need in here in New Orleans to build up some of the business, to get folks to come to our great hotels and our great restaurants. So the idea of doing a wine festival in the heat of the summer down here in Louisiana is when we decided to do this. So the idea was to get people to come to New Orleans and try some of the great food that we do down here and match it with some wonderful wines from all over the world. It has since grown. We're now in our 19th year. It's hard to believe. I know Randy and I have probably participated in this event for each of the 19 years in some form or fashion. And it's just been a fun event. I mean, the chefs really go way out. I mean, we actually have an awards event associated with the food that we prepared. So the chefs are actually competing when you go to the Grand Tasting, those 60 restaurants that are spread out along the floor of the most famous building in the world, the Louisiana Superdome, home of the championship Saints. You know, lots of great things have happened there. And we give out awards, and so everybody really goes way, way out to do a phenomenal job. And just match with, I think we've got over 1,000 wines this year. I mean, what a good time. You can't go wrong with that.
Those of you in our hometown of Pittsburgh know the Pittsburgh Wine Festival is a pretty good event. But they hold that in the executive level of the area surrounding the stadium. In the case of the NAWFE, the New Orleans Wine and Food Experience, the whole floor of the Superdome is taken up with food. So we're going for the first time. Just tomorrow night, we're expecting to have a wonderful time. The website is www.nowfe.com. It's not too early to start thinking about coming here next year, same time, same place. Gentlemen, thank you so much for talking to us.
All right, thank you very much. We had a great time, and come visit our city of New Orleans. It's absolutely incredible, and Randy is going to tell you a little bit about next year's venue, where it's going to be, another famous building here in New Orleans.
Yeah, before we end this, I just wanted to let everybody know that we're moving the venue to the convention center located right on the river next year. It's going to be, it's actually a lot bigger. I don't know if we're going to use the whole thing, but it's going to be a wonderful event, so do come and see us.
Ewell Smith is the Executive Director of the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board. Welcome to On the Menu, Ewell.
It's my pleasure to be here.
We're here for the wine and food experience, but we also have some other issues going on as a result of this oil spill. Could you give us some idea of how serious this is and what's going to happen?
Well, it's very serious. Let me start with this, because there's a lot of concern from other parts of the country. Some people think we don't have any seafood left, or they think we don't have safe seafood. And our board, Louisiana Seafood Board, supports any cautionary closures or closures that have been put in place by the Department of Health and Hospitals, Department of Environmental Quality, EPA, or NOAA Fisheries. Priority number one for us is the safety of the consumer. No product is going to go to market from any area that's been closed. That's the bottom line. With that said, we still have 70% of our coastline that is still open. Now, that could change tomorrow, but right now we're at 70% of our coastline, which is an enormous amount of coastline. And the Gulf of Mexico is an enormous body of water. So we still have fishermen going to work doing what they did just 3 or 4 weeks ago, bringing safe seafood to market, doing this exact same thing right now in the areas that are open, the 70% of our shorelines that are open. So we absolutely have safe seafood. And the great restaurateurs in New Orleans are serving the Louisiana seafood all across our state. So we have seafood that goes all over the United States. We have safe seafood. That's the bottom line.
Now, you are a consumer organization?
We are an organization that represents all the commercial fishermen and the processors in Louisiana. Our job is to keep the markets alive and well for those fishermen that can continue to work right now. So we're doing everything we can to keep the markets going, because this is a huge, the fishing community is an enormous community in Louisiana. We provide 30% of the nation's domestic seafood in the continental U.S. We provide 70% of all the Gulf seafood comes from our state. So this is of significant importance to us and to the rest of the nation. It's an American issue, and we're doing everything we can to keep safe seafood going to market.
Now, what's going to happen to the fishermen who can't work, though, because there's 30% that's closed? What does that mean for them in the long term, do you think?
For the short term, we hope they're getting compensated, and they will get compensated by BP. The long term is the big question mark that I think everybody doesn't know, because we don't know what's going to happen to the estuaries, for the areas that the oil has, you know, gotten into, which is a small area right now. It looks bigger than it is on TV. But for the smaller areas it has gotten into, it's going to have a profound impact on. Don't know exactly what that means for the long term of our fishermen. And how long can the fishermen hang on to? Can BP fund them long enough so they can hang on? There's a lot of questions that need to be answered. And we really won't know that for a little while.
You know, it makes me cry to see what happens with the wildlife. Have they stopped the spill yet?
Well, today's the day they're doing the top kill. And what we've learned so far today is that they have stopped it, but they still have some work to do. They got to come back and put the concrete on top of it. So we're hoping that holds. If that holds, that is critical for us, because right now that will at least give us a defined moment in time where we can start looking, okay, now it's time to move forward. As long as this keeps going on, we're left out in limbo, and it creates the uncertainty we talked about. The biggest fear right now everybody has is the fear of the unknown. So that will help alleviate some of that fear if we can get that thing capped today. Then we can start addressing cleanup and so forth.
Oh, yeah, the major cleanup, I know that.
Now, the last time we were here, we talked to John Besh, and we said about post-Katrina and what had it meant for seafood, and he said the most curious thing is that for the seafood industry, it was really wonderful because the high tides and the fast-moving water really cleared out all the channels, and the seafood has been generally better and better, better than it's been in a lifetime. Is that your experience, too?
That's a pretty accurate statement. If you ever saw the movie Forrest Gump and you saw what happened after the hurricane came in, the catches were at record levels. And that pretty much has happened. All of our fisheries had fully recovered. Actually, we're going to have banner year for oysters this year. So to go through four major hurricanes and now face this, it's a little disheartening. But we represent all the fishing communities, and these are some of the most hardworking individuals that you'll ever come across, and sincere individuals. And they can make it through this. They'll continue to do what they've done for 7 and 8 generations, some of these families.
Well, now, I've been reading that despite all of this, Louisianans still want the oil. They don't want this to precede stopping this offshore drilling.
Well, if you look at the way Louisiana, Louisiana has two businesses that really made Louisiana, our seafood community and our oil community. The oil industry, they harvest what's below the seabed floor. Our fishermen harvest what's above the seabed floor. And we coexist here in Louisiana. If you look at, you know, a fisherman, their uncles and cousins and brothers and sisters may work in the oil business. So there's a lot of crossover between the two. Some of them work in the oil business when they're not fishing. To do away with the oil business doesn't make, you know, that would not make a whole lot of sense for Louisiana. I'm not discounting accountability. BP needs to be held fully accountable for what they've done. And procedures need to be put in place so this never happens again.
And the oversight, apparently, that was a big issue, the oversight, the accepting bribes.
Well, the oversight, those are issues that will be worked out, I'm sure, at levels above what we do. Our focus right now is to get the fishermen that are out there working, can have the market strong so they can continue to work, and get those fishermen that aren't working, hopefully they are made whole. And our mission is to keep those engines moving.
And when will we be able to definitively say that this is reality, that that there's not going to be any more of this?
That's a good question. I think Alaska is dealing with it 20 years later, and I think we're going to be dealing with it for a long time, too.
Well, I thank you very much for talking to us about this. It has us all very concerned, all of us who love Louisiana. Are you local?
I grew up here. My grandfather ran the largest shrimp cannery in the United States before it went out of business. And so this is near and dear to my heart. And the best way people can help us literally right now is to go out and ask for Louisiana seafood, or go out to the, you know, where they're dining, or if they're going to the retail store, and supporting all the Gulf fisheries, because they're all going to be feeling the pain of this for a while.
Sign me up.
We'll be happy to, and we've got some great chefs to cook some food for you.
The Humanitarian of the Year Award this year for the James Beard Foundation Awards was so warm-heartedly felt by just about everybody in the audience. It went to the chefs and restaurateurs of New Orleans, and who accepted the award is Frank Brightson of Brightson's Restaurant, which is a spectacular restaurant we've been to also. But he's agreed to just tell us a little bit about what, first of all, do you feel about this award, and where are you going in reconstruction of New Orleans? We all love that food scene.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. Well, you know, everything for us after the storm is a milestone. The first Mardi Gras after the storm was a milestone and was the best ever. The first Jazz Fest after the storm was the best ever. And so this evening here, where we're all together for the first time, all in one place, sharing our stories and our love for food and the food community, is very, very special to us. And a chance to tell our story, which is what we really need. We need people to come visit New Orleans and visit the things that they know and love about New Orleans, but also see some of the damage and destruction that we're living with and understand it. I think that's the most important. Television has done a great job, but when you see the scale of it, you understand it. And you can still have fun and do a lot of good for us.
Now, what percentage of restaurants would you say are back?
Roughly 75% of restaurants in Orleans Parish are open. I think that's very strong. And restaurants really have been beacons of light after the storm, because restaurants really define who we are. New Orleanians come to visit us for the first time since the storm, and they say, thank you for being here. This is why we live here. Our food and our music is what defines us. It is who we are. And we missed it, and we got it back, and we ain't letting go.
Now, you're here with Leah Chase of Doogie Chase. Now, what happens to the small mom-and-pop restaurants in this community?
Well, New Orleans has always been a city of small businesses, and independent restaurants are our strength, actually. And Doogie Chase and Miss Leah have a long road to hoe. They had water in there, but everybody is coming together to help her raise money, actually get in there and rip out what needs to be ripped out, and help her get back on her feet. Because she wants to be back in her kitchen in a big, big way.
I love New Orleans, and all of what you are doing just shows why. I mean, it's all united with the heart and the soul, and I bless you all.
Thank you so much. Well, I've always said that we are in the food business, but most importantly, it's a people business. And the people and their strength is what's going to help us rebuild. Thank you.
We've got a real treat here. We've got Miss Leah of Doogie Chase, an absolute institution, an iconic restaurant in New Orleans, and she's going to tell us she's coming back.
Yes, I'll be back about middle of July, and we'll be back strong again. We had so much water. You know, we had 5 feet in some areas, 2.5 feet in my dining room, so all of that had to be lost, everything in my kitchen, so that has to be replaced. But we're going to do it. You know, that's the only thing I know, honey, is cooking, so I'm going to be back there feeding the people again.
Well, everybody knows this is why you go to New Orleans, eat your food. Yes.
Oh, calories.
Right. Miss Leah, thank you.
Thank you so much, dear. Thank you for having me. Thank you for being here.
And with that, we can take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Back again, and On the Menu's bringing to you a restaurant experience that was really wonderful New Orleans.
Before we rush into that, we jumped off of a break because we knew you needed a break, and we needed a break. But I think we should comment that these New Orleanians, or however they style themselves, sure have a lot of spunk. They sure come back. Leah Chase talked about opening her restaurant within about 6 months. It turned out, I think it took till 2009, but it is open again.
Yep.
And Brightson's was open within just a very short period of time. And in both cases, I think, whether their restaurants were open or not, these chefs were involved in feeding people who needed to be fed. And we should put in a good word for our good old friend, Chef John Besh, because we discovered during the time we were there, but not only was he sporting everything that was going on, but he was one of the first people to rush down to the area where all the workers were trying to deal with the oil spill and making sure they had good food prepared for them. Just as he did during Hurricane Katrina. So this is a group of people who deserve to survive. They deserve our support, and you may be sure that they'll make sure you have a good time when you go there. So don't wait for a festival. Get on a plane. Go have a good time. And now, back to what Anne was going to say before.
I don't know. You took the words right out of my mouth.
But except that a place we hadn't been before. We went on the evening when the wine dinners were scheduled for the Nalfi evenings. And we went to a restaurant called Mila, which you'll find out more about the name and more about the people who run it. We had missed it before, not because we didn't know about it, but because we just couldn't fit it into our schedule. So we were delighted to do it this time. And here's the story.
One of the highlights of the New Orleans wine and food experience is the wine dinners we have the winemakers paired with chefs, and they put together these wonderful dinners for all of us attending. And we lucked out, and we got Mila, where I feel like we're friends, Allison, although, I mean, I follow your career, but we've never met before now. Allison Vines Rushing, who is co-chef with her husband, Slade Rushing, of this wonderful restaurant, Mila, which stands for?
Mississippi and Louisiana.
Your hometowns.
Right.
I mean, states.
Home states, yep.
Now, you were paired, I thought it was an unusual wine, Niner.
Yeah.
Because we had just been at a Paso Robles wine tour, and mm-hmm. had not met them. But it's an unusual wine. How did you proceed to work that wine into your menu?
Well, I mean, we certainly did some things that we did more of a robust menu, honestly, than we typically do.
Because it's sort of Italianate wine.
Right, yeah. I mean, her wines are big wines, and yeah, definitely Italian, robust. I mean, she does Sangiovese and Barolos, you know.
And she, by the way, that we're talking about is Amanda Kramer, who's the winemaker.
Right, right. And we were really excited to work with a woman winemaker. I mean, I seek them out.
You're getting to be many. There are more and more and more of them.
Right, and yeah. It's wonderful. We always look for them on our list. We have quite a few women on our list these days.
Well, I think women tend to be very good winemakers.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Us women, yes, indeed.
Absolutely. Women add a nice balance. Sometimes there can be a good amount of subtlety, I think,
right.
In wine made by women or food made by women. It doesn't always kind of hit you over the head, I think. So we were really happy to work with Amanda. And she has some kind of local ties, or Niner does.
Yeah,
so
her best friend was here, yeah.
Yeah, so that was really great. But we definitely did some items. I mean, we did like a pig cheek ravioli with broccoli rabe. We brought in a lot of Italian things, really strong, big flavors to try to match her wine as best we could. You know,
I loved the scallop salad with fennel, lemon vinaigrette, and espalette.
Nice. Well, good.
It was really very good.
Thank you. And the vinaigrette, you know, we do kind of an emulsified vinaigrette. It's got a bit of gelatin in it, actually, and it makes it really silky
oh, so
and creamy.
That's why.
And then, yeah, so it's the scallops are so sweet. It pairs nice with the citrus. Of course, the wine has citrus notes, so whites are often really easy to do pairings with.
Now, I mean, I think that this food is a little bit richer than you usually do, isn't it?
It is. I mean, definitely.
The second course, the velouté of the shiitakes with creme fraiche and fava beans, that was so rich.
Yeah.
it was very satiny. It was very flavorful, but it was rich.
It was. And, you know, normally we do things much lighter, especially compared with other New Orleans restaurants.
Yes.
Because we personally like to eat light most of the time. And here it's easy to kind of overindulge. But, I mean, but as far as, you know, whenever we do wine dinners, Slade and I are very, very focused on doing the best we can with the pairings and what's going to be best with the wine. So a lot of times we'll kind of veer off things we normally do. And that's a lot of fun, too, because we get to kind of think outside of our comfort zone. But her food definitely needed some richness.
And we got some, yeah. The other course, we're moving... grilled rack of lamb with asparagus puree, which had a lot of butter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It does have a lot of butter, yes.
Yeah, this is New Orleans, after all.
Right.
And glazed pearl onions. And then the killer dessert, which was hot chocolate tart with pistachio cream and a spiced tuile. And you used it. I mean, we've had that. It's a Sicilian nut cream.
Right, pistachio paste. Yeah. I mean, we added cream to it. We kind of added whipped chantilly cream and added it to the pistachio paste.
But that's a specialty of Sicily, isn't it?
Right, right. And yeah.
I mean,
I never knew
that, but it is.
Yeah, we had several jars of it that we got as a sample, and I ate them straight out of the jar from the refrigerator till they were gone. You have an interesting combination.
Yeah,
Allison and Slade, typically... husband and wife combinations are front of house, kitchen, and you're both in the kitchen. How does that work out?
Surprisingly, it works out really well for us. We met in the kitchen working together, so we've kind of always worked together. There was a couple of years where we didn't in New York. We worked at separate restaurants, but that was only a short amount of time. We've been together for about 10 years now, and maybe there was maybe 2 years where we weren't working in the same kitchen. So,
weren't you on the West Coast, too? Didn't you do something on
Slade
the West
was.
Coast?
He lived out in San Francisco, and he was a pastry chef out there at Rubicon. But he worked as savory in a lot of different restaurants. But, yeah, he was out there.
So why did you want to come back? South.
Yeah, because it is home. And when we were young cooks in New York, oftentimes we'd come home after work and we'd be like brainstorming and coming up with menu ideas and things that, you know, we kind of were formulating our future cuisine, I guess, back then. And it just ended up being very Southern inspired and you know, because it's who we are. So we kind of took what we've learned in other places and we certainly apply it. But, you know, our inspiration is what we've always known. And a lot of times people down south, chefs don't really get out of the south very often. They are trained here in New Orleans. They're trained here. They stay here. So we thought it was a really great thing that we got away and that we brought it back home.
And your timing, though, was a little curious.
Our
Tell
timing
us about
is
that.
Always bad, yeah. Our timing is terrible. We moved to New York City 3 months before September 11th, and then we moved here 3 months before Katrina. So people always say, please warn us if you're moving to our area, because obviously destruction will soon follow.
Yeah, catastrophe will follow you around.
I know. You know, but it certainly made us stronger and able to, you know, whenever things happen, they get easier and easier to deal with, you know.
Are you more flexible?
Yeah. Well, you just have to roll with it. And what I've learned is whenever bad things happen, good things happen soon after. As long as if you get through that bad part, you'll be rewarded. I mean, if had we not stayed in New York City after September 11th, which we certainly talked about going home then, because I lost my job. I mean, there was a lot of turmoil. But we ended up sticking out, and then all these wonderful things happened to us there.
Where were you at times?
Oh, at the kitchen I worked in was Picheline on the Upper West Side. And Slade was at March on the Upper East Side. And so we kind of survived on a cook's salary for quite some time there, which is one cook's salary, which is not easy to do in New York City. Actually, it's pretty challenging.
You better know how to cook, I guess.
Yeah, well, that we do. We get very creative. I mean, back then especially, we'd open our fridge and it had like a sweet potato in it and something else. Okay. And we ended up making some of the best things we've ever made with really limited resources. But but we like to do that, you know. We like to be creative, so... Yeah, so we.
Who was it we interviewed after they're both chefs that come home and they have the contest to see who could make the most creative pasta in the shortest amount of time?
Oh, it was the people from Al Forno in Providence, Rhode Island. Husband and wife, and they wrote a cookbook together. And
about said, these things, they crazy this, pastas they, said,
this,
they made.
Yeah,
up.
This is how we sort of got into it.
Right.
That we were hungry after we got home, so we would make pasta, and we'd have a contest. And the main contest you have with Al Forno is trying to get a seat after 5:30 in the evening because they don't take reservations. But that's a kind of a different story. Now, it must be interesting to be part of there's a community of chefs here, a real family and a real feeling that chefs should grow together in New Orleans. Have you been a part of that movement?
We certainly have a lot of friends here. And yeah, I mean, chefs here are very close. Not so competitive. I mean, New York, you're competitive with everyone, and you definitely, it's a palpable feeling. Here, not so much. You know, everybody kind of does their thing. Whenever we get together at different events, it's like, hey, you know, big hugs, how are you doing? You know, everybody's always generally happy to see one another and to, you know, get a chance to hang out. So, yeah, it is. It's a great community. It's also New Orleans, you know, it's more laid back, and there's such a focus on enjoying life and not the kind of stress that we had in New York, you know, much different.
So you're really happy here?
Absolutely, yes.
And
we love New
Orleans. Have you sort of suddenly hit upon some new food passion that you have since you've been here?
New food passion, like as far as what we do in the restaurant or just...
Yeah, I mean,
like,
what would you like to... What do you like to cook different... I mean, how has your style changed with either your menus?
Well, you know, it's funny. I hadn't had fried catfish in years. And I grew up on fried catfish. In my family, if we were having fish, it was catfish. There was never any other fish represented. And this is in North Louisiana. And it's been years since I've eaten catfish. Well, now it's like I crave it like once a week or, you know, I'm eating catfish very often.
Well, I'm going to have to eat your catfish because I've never had catfish that I've liked.
Really? Oh, I love it. I mean, you know, maybe it's because I grew up with it. But, yeah. I love it. I do. So, yeah, kind of country things like that I've rediscovered. Things I grew up
with. Is there some New Orleans chef that you're totally in awe of?
Well, let's see.
There's so many of them.
There's so many. Susan Spicer I've become good friends with.
Oh, yeah, Susan.
It's such a pleasure to know her. She's amazing. And when I was a younger chef, I was just in absolute awe of her. I just thought she was so amazing, and I'll never forget eating at Bayona and what an experience that was and thinking, wow, maybe one day I'll have a restaurant like this. So now just knowing her on a personal level has meant so much, and she's just really supportive of me and do anything for me, and that kind of relationship is just something I never thought I'd have. So that's really amazing. I couldn't like her any more than I do. You know, she's wonderful.
I actually thought you might say Slade.
Well, yeah, I mean,
but she's known him before New Orleans, yeah.
Right. Slade and I, we definitely have different strengths, which I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, who's strength? I mean, I'm looking at the menu, but who does what essentially?
Well, a lot of times. sometimes I do salads just because I've spent a good amount of time in garde manger as a cook. A lot of time, actually. I also spent a lot of time in the vegetable stations when I worked at Alain Ducasse. I always did vegetables, so, and I really, really enjoy working with vegetables. So I do a lot of that. I do a lot of the fish dishes just because that's what I like to eat. And I just like kind of the delicacy of cooking fish and the lightness of the dishes. So those are things I kind of focus on. Slade, I do help with other things, but Slade, of course, is a meat man. He's really talented.
He likes the offal.
Oh yeah, definitely. And he's very talented with that. Meat sauces, he's amazing with. Very talented in pastry. Now we have a caramel souffle on the menu that we make, you know, a la minute. And so I feel like he can do anything when it comes to.
So if you get a plate coming out of the kitchen, it might have had four hands on it.
Definitely had Slade in mind as far as the ideas.
That's what I meant, four.
Absolutely, yes. As opposed to two, for sure. Yeah. We rarely do a dish without consulting the other one about it first.
Oh, really? That's nice.
It's pretty much always a team effort.
When you're at home cooking, do you consult what you're eating?
Yeah, I mean, you know, at home we do very simple things at home. You know, our big thing is breakfast, so we're always making breakfast. Yeah, we love breakfast. We actually, one of our wedding vows was about breakfast and cooking breakfast.
What'd you say?
One of our vows was we promised to make breakfast every other Sunday. So that was one of the vows. But we love breakfast. We're big on that. We make pancakes a lot. We do all kinds of things. But that's a big one. But at home we're not so competitive. At home we're just happy if the other one is willing to cook.
Yeah, we understand that one.
Yeah, I mean, we're the same way that
way. Yeah, who wants to cook tonight? Yeah, yeah. I don't really feel like it, or I have a headache or something.
Well, are you on tonight for the open tasting at the big stadium or whatever it is?
No, we're actually on tomorrow, Saturday, during the day. Yes, for the grand tasting.
The grand tasting.
We are, yes.
Well, we'll be well out of here by then, but
well,
before
we'll be well out of here, we will be out of here.
Out of here.
We will be sad to be out of here. It has really been a pleasure to have the opportunity to be in New Orleans once again.
Yeah, I wanted to get the particulars. Website?
All of the above.
Oh, okay. Well, it's the website is www.milaneworleans.com.
It's spelled M-I-L-A.
We are located on Common and Barone Streets at the corner. That's in the Central Business District, which is like one block off of Canal, opposite of the French Quarter. So,
and in a hotel.
And in a hotel called the Pierre Marquette.
You don't do the room service. And
we do, yeah.
Oh, you do all that.
Yeah, we do. We
busy
do the
couple, busy
we do
couple.
Yeah.
Well, we really appreciated the meal we had here and getting to know you, because I've read about you and followed your career for so long.
Yeah, we're just going to have to come on back and have some of the real stuff.
Right.
Absolutely.
We really need to eat a lot more. We haven't had hardly anything to eat since we've been here.
Please give our best wishes to Slade.
I will.
Who's undoubtedly slaving away in the kitchen at this moment.
I will, absolutely.
Allison, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
It's been really nice.
And it's time for another commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And of course, here we are again, and we're going to take a little bit of a sidestep from our usual focus on food and wine, but I have to tell you, the street event, I always say that it's in New Orleans, you get a band and you got a procession. You do a wine tasting, you got all these people dressed up as grapes. But we got a tip that led us to the best place for walking down the street, getting off the street, and walking into a huge, gorgeous venue for sampling food and wine, an antique store. That was spectacular. Probably the most spectacular antique store I've ever seen, called M.S. Rao.
So we went back there the next day to talk to one of the people to find out more about the experience. Now we should quickly point out that the stroll we took was down Royal Street.
Royal.
Which is one street away, but a couple of decades apart, or
from
centuries
Bourbon.
Apart, from Bourbon Street.
right,
which runs parallel. So we were strolling Royal Street along with lots and lots of people who were our friends, thought they might like to become our friends.
Oh, yeah, they were. They stayed dressed, but many were in costume.
They were indeed.
And beads everywhere, of course. This is New Orleans.
But the antiques were the story.
On the menu discovered in the midst of this wonderful wine and food experience in New Orleans, a shop that took my breath away, which was one of the venues, actually, for the food and drink for the experience on our big stroll on Royal Street. We were so enthralled with this place called Raoul Antiques. It's the bestest of all the antique shops or anything even close to it I've ever seen. So we had to have a discussion with somebody who knows all about it, who's a long-term employee, and this is Philip with two L's, Youngberg. Try it again. Philip Youngberg, tell us about this store.
We probably have one of the most exciting stores in the United States. Where can you come and see a painting by Monet, cave bear skeleton that's 150,000 years old, an Enigma machine from World War II, all under the same roof, amongst Georgian silver, American silver. We're a museum with price tags. It's really exciting. Everyone who comes in our store just has that wow factor.
You got it. This is a museum. It's not just a shop. And, of course, we wandered through. There are always long lines at all the stations offering food and wine. So we got to look at all this stuff. And I said, this is a family business, and I want this family to adopt me. Tell us the history.
Well, this is the third generation. Bill Rao runs the store today, but it was started by his great-grandfather about 1908. And then his father, Joe Rao, continued, and Bill Rao took over about the middle 80s and really took it to the highest level we've ever been.
Something of everything. You indicated some of this range, but what are you most known for?
We're most known for the finest, the best, and unusual. You know, you take a look at paintings. Right now we have a painting by Monet. We have a painting by Pizarro, Sicily. We've had monumental paintings by William Bouguereau. So we're known for many things. Like, we do a lot of shows worldwide and in the United States, and we go to shows. Our strength is our wide approach to merchandise. I mean, we'll have like great paintings. We'll have Georgian silver. We'll have American Tiffany silver. We have Tiffany lamps. We have bronze. I mean, we've sold bronzes by Rodin over the years. We have great furniture. I mean, we have French furniture. We have signed French pieces. We have 18th century. We have English pieces. We have a chest, Oyster Burl chest, that's 300 years old. And we have American furniture as well. So it's a wide selection of merchandise that you never know what people are going to buy. So we always have the unusual in many different categories.
Where does the stuff come from?
That's a good question. I mean, where... 15 years ago, people did not know the Rao name. Now they do. We travel Europe. You know, you hear people in the background, Mr. Rao's in town. I mean, people save the best things for us. They know we're players at every level. And we get to see things the average dealer in person does not. And if you we do a lot of advertising. We had a great campaign in the Wall Street Journal recently, and we're in there every week with something unusual and different. So if you have something great for sale, you probably give us a shot first. I mean, we're very picky. We only buy the best, but a lot of things come our way because who we are and our reputation we've built up over the years.
Give us a contact. Website?
www.rowantiques.com. We have... I've been told by other dealers in the business and, of course, our clients, we have one of the best websites out there. We have a new additions. It's fun. You should definitely go see it. You'll see things you've never seen before. And you'll be coming away saying, I have to go to visit Rao Antiques in New Orleans. And we're right in the French Quarter, right in the middle of the French Quarter. We're a stone's throw from Jackson Square.
Who actually is your customer?
Our customer is, that's a good question. You know, what we've been doing differently than most dealers here in New Orleans and everywhere else for the past 10 years, I guess the first show we did was in Dallas in 2000. So we do all the major shows. We do shows in Dallas, we do them in New York, we do them in Palm Beach. We even did a show in Dubai. Our customer, I've always said if you know, you really need to be in the path of people spending money who like nice things. And you just can't just open your door and expect people to come in. So going to these shows, we meet people who just collect. What we do best is we build collections for people. If you came to us and you bought a painting by Renoir, well, over the next few years, you may buy 4 or 5 paintings by Renoir. Or maybe we'd expand it. We've done great things with silver, you know. Our silver. We have Paul Revere Silver, you know, the greatest American patriot and silversmith. We have Paul Storr, Paul Delarmery. And we have people where they've purchased 30 or 40 pieces over, you know, a 5-year period of certain types of silversmith and collections. So that's the fun part of our business, is building collections for people.
You said here's this silver set. It's $60,000, and it's going to be gone this afternoon. How do you know?
Well, we keep very good records. Over the past 10 years, if you came in our store and you said one day you'd want a set of silver, I would make a note of it. So we got this set of silver by Gorm just recently. It's over 300 pieces. It was made in 1890, one of the heaviest, beautiful sets. So I had 200 people I emailed today who had interest in owning a great silver set. I had about, out of those 300 people, I had 5 people today that expressed interest wanting to know more about it and to see pieces. So I would say, let me backtrack for a minute. We're the type of store, if I tell you, you love it, buy it now because it probably won't be here around. It is true. It won't be around. I guess one of the funniest stories we have right now a surprise chair in the back. It's an English surprise chair. It was made for a Presbyterian minister in Scotland. And in the chair is concealed 4 decanters, shot glasses, cigars. But at first glance, it just looks like a normal chair. Well, when a piece comes in, we automatically take pictures and we send it to clients. You know, email and print. So one Saturday afternoon about a year ago, I had a client come in looking for a billiard table, but he saw this chair, and I explained the chair to him. He says, boy, that would be cool to own. I said, listen, why don't you get it right now? It could be sold at any time. He looked at me and he laughed. He said, Phil, I'm just going to go look at the billiard table. We'll come back in 10 minutes and I'll make up my mind. By the time I came back, there was a sign that was sold on there. I thought someone was playing a joke with me. But sure enough, a guy from Texas had seen an email that was sent the day before, and he bought it. And the guy today is telling that story. I mean, we sell things. You know, we carry the unusual. And I guess what's fun is what sets one home, your home, different from someone else's home, is owning unusual and great things. I mean, that's what's fun about, you know, decorating things in your house. And that's what we do.
Now, you do a lot of sales over phones and internet, right?
Yes, we do. You know, we our website, we're like a entertainment. You go to our website, you'll be entertained. The chances are you're going to find something, and you will call us the next day. And listen, how much is that piece on the website?
I found lots of things. I can't afford any of it.
I can't afford it either, but it sure was fun looking at it. The nice part about it is they don't charge admission. They don't charge admission on the website either. Philip LL, it was a pleasure to talk to you, and we better let you get back to work because you got a $60,000 silver set to sell today. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was fun.
Now we're going to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back, although my mind still wanders to all those wonderful things I wanted at the Rowles.
Yeah, what didn't you want to buy?
Well, I would have absolutely preferred the opal bead necklace with the diamond clasp to the skeleton of the bear. But at any rate, we're moving on, changing subject a bit. We're moving on to wine.
I did think Double L Philip was very nice about describing the kinds of people who were their customer, allowing the speculation that he might think we were among the money class who could afford the stuff that was there, which of course
not
we are
hardly.
Not. But a big part, obviously, of New Orleans is the food business. This is a restaurant scene. This is not an area where they grow grapes and make wine, but they do have a great love of wine. And that's evident in the huge number of wineries who assemble on the floor of the Superdome to offer their wares in the two grand tasting events that take place during the festival. We went to just one of them, and that was enough to exhaust
that
us
was certainly enough,
and make
yes.
it time for us to come home. But a winemaker with a fascinating story from a slightly unusual California wine location traveled all the way to New Orleans to meet us and, I guess, a few other thousand of his best friends as well. So we had an opportunity to talk to John Concannon about the history of his winery and a new range of wines that they're introducing at a very aggressive and very suitable price point.
And then we also went back to the Pittsburgh Wine Festival.
Yeah, this is a great time in which to include another wine story.
He was a wonderful interview.
Yes, he was. And he was from Italy, from a region that's been making wine a few centuries longer than John Concannon, although John Concannon's been after a business for a while, too. So here we have John Concannon, and then we have a representative from Fiudi,
yeah,
in Campania, Italy.
It was wonderful, wonderful spoken, wonderfully spoken, I guess you'd say.
And both, incidentally, excellent wines for the money.
The Livermore Valley in California came all the way to New Orleans so we could meet them. John Concannon's business card says fourth generation vintner. There's obviously a story here. It's a story that goes back to the 1840s and across the big pond. John, begin the story for us.
Well, Peter, it's a pleasure to be with you here in New Orleans. My great-grandfather was born in the Aran Islands near Galloway Bay in 1847 on St. Patrick's Day, coincidentally. So I guess you might say we had the luck of the Irish in our family from the beginning. He came to America, Boston, Maine, and thousands of immigrants before and after him. And first thing he saw was a sign that said, Irish need not apply. Welcome to America. And then he met his wife, my great-grandmother, and they traveled to San Francisco, where they landed in the heavily Irish mission-populated district there.
But they didn't grow potatoes. They decided to do something different. Your great-great-great-great-grandfather had all kinds of adventures that we'll gloss over, because this is a wine story. But the start of the adventure was to get some clones of rather unusual grapes and make a rather non-standard kind of wine.
Well, that's right. I mean, an Irishman, first of all, making wine, I think, was a bit unheard of. Can only imagine his response to my great-grandmother, maybe whiskey or beer, but certainly not wine. But great-grandmother asked him to meet with the Archbishop Alemany in San Francisco about making sacramental wines for the church. And he traveled to France twice, the first time to bring back Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc cuttings back from the very famous world-renowned Chateau de Chem. And this got us through Prohibition from 1920 to 33, making wines for the church.
Although they weren't the kind of wines you're making today. So you stayed in business, but sort of only just.
Well, absolutely. Those were very big, high fortified wines back then, 22% alcohol. Certainly our wines today are much more food friendly, 13.5%, by the way, on that. So he got us through that, and grandfather got us through the worst depression and a little thing called Prohibition. They call it the Dark 13 Years, and he had a love for the military as well. And then my father, Jim Concannon, third generation, he's been at the helm out there for well over 58 years.
And you concentrated your attention on a somewhat unusual grape variety.
Well, we did. Again, when my great-grandfather went back the second time, he brought back Durif cuttings. Dr. Durif was a very famous French viticulturist who discovered this new varietal, which is a hybrid of the Syrah grape. And great-grandfather brought that back, and it's known here in America as Petite Syrah. But as we've found out today over lunch, there's certainly nothing petite about Petite Syrah. And Dad was the first to make Petite Syrah varietal in 1961, so we've trademarked the phrase America's first Petite Syrah.
Talk about it as a wine. For people who know wines generally but would say, Petite Syrah, that's supposed to be a blending grape. Why would I want to drink a wine made out of that?
Well, right. It's really a wonderful varietal that I think is starting to gain a lot of acceptance out there. It's a big, bold wine, a lot of layers, a lot of complexity to it. Great with, I would pair it with, steak, barbecue, Asian food, anything spicy. And it just really is a wonderful wine that you can enjoy now, and certainly has enough tannins with the potential to lay it down for 5 to 10 years. It's a very sacred winemaking process for it. We're doing some very old school winemaking with it. We hold it for 12 months in American oak, and then we hold it another 6 months in some 58-year-old handmade Bordeaux oak barrels, which, the wood is obviously inert, but my feeling is that the porousness of the wood, it accelerates the oxidation rate of the wine, which gives what the French like to call that nice soft mid palate. So it's certainly very drinkable now, but there's enough tannins in it where you can lay it down for 5 to 10 years.
So you're always looking, because you did something else. You grew up on a winery, then you had another career, and then you came back to making wine. Why did you do that?
Well, I did. I grew up in the house that my great-grandfather built for the original family he had from Ireland. They ended up having 10 children, and we've raised 4 generations in the house that's still out in front of the winery. I worked out the winery starting at age 12 all the way through college, and then my dad encouraged me to go out and kind of make my own name and gain experience and follow my own dreams. So I actually pursued a part of the medical field where I worked for medical device companies developing new instrumentation and techniques for minimally invasive surgery. And I did that for well over 20 years. And now recently, over the last couple of years, I've come back to the winery full time. So my life has really traveled full circle. My last job was my first job. And it really ties into this new line of wines that we were talking about today called Conservancy. And we can talk a little bit about that if you'd like.
Oh, that's a natural, because that's the next thing I was planning to talk to you about anyway, because the wine business in California has changed a little bit with the last couple of years of people having a rather less disposable income than they once had. So you decided to respond to that.
Well, we have. Concannon's always been known for over-delivering the price point and offering a good value, and that certainly ties in with the economic times of today. Coming back full-time to the winery, what has really been hitting me is how it's old is new. You know, we're employing some of the newest winemaking techniques, but it's not really new technology. It's things that my great-grandfather did 127 years ago. We were one of first 17 wineries to be certified sustainable in California, and, you know, 127 years ago, they didn't use any chemicals, pesticides, or herbicides. So what we're all about is preserving a way of life, preserving our old winemaking techniques, our family, our heritage, and most importantly, our land. And that's what the Conservancy name implies. Basically, we've taken all of our land, and we're located 20 miles east of the San Francisco Bay, so it's not exactly inexpensive real estate out that way. And we've put in a permanent land trust, so it'll never succumb to urban sprawl. All of the juice for these wines that we're tasting, the Conservancy wines, which include a Chardonnay, a Merlot, a Cabernet, and a Petite, come from vineyard in this land trust.
Another great piece of news, I think, for all you people out there who think families are important, there's another generation coming along, right, John?
Well, we do. We do. We have 3 fifth generations in the wings. The oldest is a woman, and her name is Shannon Concannon, good Irish name, so hopefully we didn't mess her up too much with that. And she's a very serious 12-year-old, and she enjoys Irish step dancing, has a little dog named Jake, and she's been asking to want to know more about the wine business. So women have actually played a very important part in the Concannon history, starting with my great-grandmother and God love her, raising 10 children. But second of all, we had America's first professional female winemaker from 1950 to 1960, Catherine Vita. She was a Hungarian ballerina who escaped war-torn Hungary and came to America, and grandfather hired her as our winemaker from 1950 to 1960, and she taught my dad the principles of winemaking. So women have certainly played an important role in the history of Concannon.
Well, it's a fascinating story. It's an not exactly a traditional wine-growing region, although John tells me there are now 40 wineries in the Livermore Valley, so maybe it's going to go the same way as Paso Robles and other parts of the Central Coast and get even bigger. But regardless, it's going to be there for the duration. It's green, it's sustainable, it's biodynamic, it's all those things that you would want. And the best part about it, family-owned and run with a sensitivity, I think, of the heritage that you have, don't you think?
Well, we like to think all that. You know, the nice thing is there's been a Concannon at the helm for the past 127 years. We've had family involvement that entire time, and you just don't see a lot of that, unfortunately, with wineries these days. The sustainability is very important, the conservancy, preserving our land, and we wanted to build a winery that would carry us on to the next century, so we've actually built the most advanced solar-powered winery in the United States, one of them, and so we have not only one of the most advanced wineries in the United States, but 100 yards from that, the oldest winery, and they play very well together. So we're trying to do all the right things.
Now, we need to add here a website where people can find out about availability of Conservancy and the other Concannon wines. Go ahead, John.
Well, we have a website, concannonvineyard.com, you can go to, and certainly if you have any questions or need any more information, you can go to that website to find it. We're also found on Facebook and Twitter, and we're distributed through all 50 states in the United States. So if you don't see us in your local grocery store or liquor store, please ask the wine buyer, and he can certainly make it available to you.
Thank you so much, John. Have a great time for the rest of the New Orleans Wine Festival and throughout the rest of your brilliant family making more great wines.
Well, thank you, Peter, very much. It was a pleasure. And I think the bottom line is I think my great-grandfather would be very proud to have his family name on our current vintage. Thank you again for your time.
What fun it is to meet someone from a wine region that you don't know very much about. You sort of think you like it, but you're also certain that you really don't know a lot about it. So what a wonderful opportunity to talk to a real expert, Maurizio De Rosa, from Feudi di San Gregorio, from the region of Campania. Maurizio, first of all, explain where that is.
Well, the winery is located 50 miles east of Naples, roughly 200 miles south of Rome. Of course, in the beginning it was an Etruscan settlement. The people that settled my area were the Sunnites. Then eventually the Greeks colonized the area. And they brought additional viticulture to the area. And they brought a lot of grape varietals that we still grow today, from Greco di Tufo, Falanghina, and Fiano d'Avellino for the whites, and Aglianico for the red grapes.
Now, these are wines that in the United States are not well known. They're very well known in Italy. I know Campania is very famous as an agricultural region in Italy. Some Roman emperor, I think, once said, world, and you probably could give the world enough to drink as well. But explain what makes Campania so special.
Well, I think it's really the fact that the landscape is very eclectic. You have a coastal region that is ideal for fishing. You have, of course, then the countryside, where the Caserta area is very swampy, so it's suitable for the raising of buffalo, water buffalo. That's why so much mozzarella. You have tall mountains as you approach the area of Avellino and Benevento, and that's where we're located. So they're especially suitable for grape growings. And then, of course, you have the Salerno area that is far more diverse, swamp in some area, green in some others. So you have incredible agricultural products.
But you've got great weather, you've got warm, you've got warmth, you've got sunshine, and you've got some great soil too, I think.
Well, we have some great volcanic soil that has made the area very rich. Where we grow grapes especially, there is most of the volcanic debris that fell from the explosion of Mount Vesuvius 2,000 years ago. Therefore, it made my area very sought after because the wines have high-level minerality. Furthermore, of course, we all know that some of the tomato growers, the famous San Marzano tomato, express itself best in volcanic soil. So therefore, not just for grapes, but also for products that are quintessential to my cuisine, I will say the volcanic nature of the soil has given us plenty.
So you've got wonderful wines, and then you've got tomatoes, mozzarella, and what might you make out of that that you would drink wine with, I wonder?
Okay. Well, I mean, if you make a caprese sala with the best mozzarella you can find and the best tomato you can find, my suggestion, of course, is to drink a good Greco di Tufo.
Now, I was leading towards the answer to the question being pizza, which of course Naples is famous.
Well, actually, the pizza margherita is rather a recent discovery. Legend is that I think 1878 Queen Margherita was visiting Naples, and a famous Neapolitan pizzaiolo, his name was Esposito. He was working in a pizzeria called Brandi, an historical pizzeria in Naples, decided to make a pizza in honor of Queen Margherita. And it was the first time that he combined tomato, mozzarella, and basil because to recreate the color of the Italian flag in her honor. Red with the tomato, white with mozzarella, and green with the basil. And he offered the pizza to Queen Margherita. They loved it. And therefore, the name came Pizza Margherita. However, that's a very recent pizza. Most likely pizza before was made with lard. Neapolitans were even too poor to afford olive oil, so it was just a flatbread with lard on top.
Now, the red grape of the region, Aglianico, is that Aglianico di Vulture?
Vulture is a different area. Vulture is in Basilicata. Our Aglianico is Aglianico Erpino, of course. Taurasi being the epicenter of the cultivation of Aglianico grape in my area. It's a grape of great prestige, great history. There is some historical record that Hannibal drank the wine before he fought the Roman. He felt better, and he decided to win the Battle of Zama. However, I will say that Aglianico has been, for the last 2,000 years, the most prominent grape in my area.
So let's run down those grapes again, and then we'll ask you to reintroduce Faiudi de San Gregorio, and perhaps you can feed the website into our recording too.
Well, we have Falanghina, of course, as a white grape, Fiano d'Avellino, and Greco di Tufo. As a red grape, we have Aglianico, prevalently known in the town of Taurasi, in the commune of Taurasi. Therefore, we make two different types of Taurasi. And we make also a different wine called Serpico, where we source the grape from Prefiloxera vines. We have few vines that survive Phylloxera. Because of the volcanic nature of the soil, what happened was a lot of volcanic ashes fell on this property. And volcanic ashes, they stayed in a very sandy type of stage, and Phylloxera found it impossible to penetrate those grounds.
That was a lucky thing, right?
Lucky thing for only six hectares. The rest of the viticulture in Campania was entirely destroyed. We do have some Prefiloxera vines, but not to the extent that we would like to have.
Well, the website is www.feudi.it. Encourage you to check it out. Check out the wines from this wonderful, sunny, volcanic region of Italy called Campania.
Well, I hope you come to Campania more than taste the wine in the U.S. There is plenty to see. You'll never get bored. From the ruins to Pompeii, to the cliffs of Sorrento, to the beaches in the Falerno area, to the mountains in Irpinia, to the greenery of Salerno, of course.
Well, Anne and Peter have been several times, but you're reminding us that we need to come again. So we'll do that, and perhaps we'll come and see you when we get there.
I'll wait for you there.
Well, I guess that's another week wrapped.
Yes, it is.
And until next week.
Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.